Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of the present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, a History. And his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And the Arab uprisings, of course, are a mixed bag. I think the one thing in common is that the United States, the lone superpower, seems to have little influence over the outcomes, or of course, with the exception of, I suppose, Libya, in as much as the U.S. led the NATO intervention there. But let's start with Egypt, because that was one of the big shoes and the second to drop after Tunisia. And now you see the military, who don't want to cede power, completely basically canceling almost all of the presidential candidates, disqualifying them, including the one that clearly was going to be the supporter of the military, the so-called torturer-in-chief, Suleiman. What do you make of this sort of atavistic move on the part of the military in Egypt?
Well, I think the military was always very concerned about maintaining its power in Egypt, and that's why it stepped in after only 18 days of Tahrir Square to take power in Egypt, and very, very slowly began the wheels turning to turn that power over to a parliament or to a president. The rumor had it that the military had reached some sort of agreement with the Muslim Brotherhood, the idea being that the Muslim Brotherhood would give the military immunity from prosecution for all the crimes that were committed after the 11th of February when Mubarak left, and would also allow the military to maintain its privileges, its privileged position in the economy. The military owns approximately 50% of manufacturing, for example, in Egypt, according to the IMF. In return, the military would cede power to the Muslim Brotherhood, with the understanding, of course, that they would go to their barracks, but that could be temporary. It appears that nothing of the sort has happened, however, since that time, and that we're looking at now a showdown that is imminent.
And the notion that the Muslim Brotherhood reneged on their agreement not to run a presidential candidate, they clearly will dominate the parliament. What does that say about them? And there's this lingering sense, in at least in the West, and it comes as a result of what happened in Algeria, is that when Islamists are voted in a democratic election, it's one person, one vote, one time. And that was the reason why there was that long civil war in Algeria, because of the feasts essentially wanting to, you know, gain power by democratic means and then maintain power by undemocratic means. Does that in any way apply to Egypt?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the Algeria situation was a little bit different than that. Fis won the first round of elections. They got approximately half the vote. It was at that point that the military stepped in, canceled the second round of elections, and then Algeria just descended into, I wouldn't call it a civil war, because the majority of Algerians didn't participate. It was the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, versus a group within the military called the Eradicators. You could see what they were all
enormous
about.
Enormous bloodletting went on.
They say up to approximately 100,000 to 150,000 Algerians died. And as a result of that, according to one WikiLeaks cable from the U.S. State Department, the reason why Algeria did not explode again during the Arab Spring was because of the what they call a post-traumatic stress that the society as a whole was feeling after what had occurred in the 1990s. So that was the situation in Algeria. The one thing that I think your listeners really have to understand is that we're not in that era anymore of the 1980s and the 1990s, when the paradigm for Islamic politics were these small cadre organizations, Leninist organizations that were attempting to take power. They were smashed in the 1980s, 1990s by almost all governments in the region. And what in there, what happened in that wake was two things. Number one, the only sort of Islamic organizations that could maintain themselves were Islamic organizations that would work through the system. And they became like Tammany Hall type organizations, like the Muslim Brotherhood. The Salafists at that time had not even entered into politics. They had pretty much renounced their participation in politics, the Egyptian Salafists. So we have that on the one hand. And on the other hand, what we see is this extraordinary expansion of the security apparatus in the Arab world. And it was estimated, for example, on the eve of the Egyptian uprising, that approximately 2 million Egyptians were involved in the security apparatus, all the way from ministry officials down to common snitches and thugs for hire that the government just kept on retainer to create an atmosphere of fear within society. So it was actually, you might want to say that the government won the battle in the 1980s and the 1990s against Islamist groups, but they lost the war. And that war was the bloated security establishments that they established became a focal point for the uprisings that have taken place since 2010.
But those uprisings were engaged by the young, tended to be liberal, somewhat pro-Western secularists. And didn't the Muslim Brotherhood sit it out a little bit?
Well, there's a couple of aspects of that. Number one of the problems that we have in understanding these uprisings that Americans have and that the media has had as well is that we tend to look at all the uprisings through the lens of Tunisia and through the lens of Egypt. And even that is not very accurate. For example, Initially, only the youth wing of the Muslim Brotherhood participated in the January 25th takeover of Tahrir Square. But then by the 28th, the entire Brotherhood had thrown its weight behind it. And over time, the majority of the people in Tahrir Square were Brotherhood members. They weren't the people that we would watch on television who were fluent in English and tech-savvy. There was a very, very broad-ranging coalition. For example, in both Tunisia and in Egypt, it wasn't the youth that turned the tide. It was actually labor that turned the tide. On the 10th of February, a general strike was called throughout all of Egypt. That was the point at which the army said, we can't tolerate this. We have to get rid of Mubarak. So we're looking through this through a lens that, number one, is not a true lens, and number two, it's not applicable to other places other than Egypt and Tunisia. That, for example, it wasn't the youth that went out in, for example, Libya or in Syria. It was actually the parents of the youth that went out, particularly in Syria, in the town of Daraa. In Yemen, rebellion was actually hijacked at a certain point by those who were the loyal opposition, hijacked away from the youth and labor. And people were focused on Sana'a, but actually Taiz was one of the real important centers of what was going on in Yemen. So what we see is that it wasn't just the secular youth. It wasn't the youth at all in some places, but a very, very broad coalition of the population. And the idea that the rebellions have been hijacked by Islamists, I think, is probably not a good way of looking at it. I think that the Islamists have been hijacked by the rebellions. Mm-hmm. I think that what we have going on right now is that series of uprisings that have taken place since 1988 that we've virtually ignored in the West for democratic and human rights, starting in the Black October riots in Algeria, the Bahraini Intifada, the Damascus Spring, for example, in 2000 when Bashar al-Assad just took over, the Cedar Revolution in 2005, the Damascus Program Movement in 2005. All these movements also were focused on democratic and human rights. And if we look at Islamic groups as not being something that's separate and aside from what goes on in the general political sphere, we can't help but see that these groups themselves were also involved in these things. For example, the first grouping that called for Mubarak to resign was a grouping called Kefaya, and that grouping consisted of both well, actually of leftists, as well as more middle-of-the-road secularists, as well as people affiliated with the Brotherhood and various Islamic organizations. The same thing with the Damascus Program movement. The exact same thing was going on. So we've also seen these people, Islamists, participating in campus elections for officers for student government. We've seen them participating in syndicate elections for journalist syndicates and lawyer syndicates and engineer syndicates as well. So they're very well acquainted with the political process, and they've structured themselves in a way that is more fitting towards participating in the political process than it is for some sort of 1980s, 1990s sort of rebellion.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. He's a specialist on Syria, and his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. So I guess I'm guilty of having this kind of Western suspicion of that democracy is going to be hijacked by theocracy and that theocracy is inevitable. And we do have examples, of course, of theocracy. We have a phony theocracy in Saudi Arabia. It's really a ruling family using religion as a way to keep the people down. At least that's my shorthand version of it. You have a theocracy in Iran, which the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently said has basically been hijacked by the military coup since that rigged election. So I take it just in terms of the Egyptian model, you don't think the Muslim Brotherhood is at all about theocracy, that they can coincide, because the Saudis have been pushing them, the Salafists, they've been funding them, and they clearly don't want democracy. So you have peculiar reactionary, you have the Saudi reactionaries on the one hand, and then you have the different reactionaries in Iran on the other hand, both offering up their models.
Yeah, don't get me wrong here. I don't think that there's going to be a very, very smooth road to democracy anywhere in the Middle East. I think that there's a long, long way that we have to go before we'll actually see that sort of thing taking place. But I don't see in the cards Iranian-style takeover by a grouping such as a Muslim Brotherhood or a grouping such as that pretty much anywhere in the Middle East. It's not in the cards. You know, what's interesting is that people said, okay, people like me were wrong about the Iranian Revolution and that, you know, Khomeini, we didn't see it coming. We did see it coming. He had written about this stuff for years and years about establishing a vilayet-e faqih, a rulership of the jurisconsult of the chief judge, actually. So this was on the table, and we knew about this stuff. What we didn't foresee was that he would be able to maneuver his way into the leadership position, because it was a very, very broad coalition that had taken it to the streets against the Shah in 1978-79. So I don't see that taking place any place in the Arab world. But what I do see taking place is a very, very difficult transition from what had been years and years, a half century in some places longer, of autocracies to a democratic transition, if it's going to take place at all. The best chance that we actually have is probably Tunisia, but there's real problems taking place in Tunisia as well. There are very, very strong Salafi movement, for example, in Tunisia, and there's been confrontations that have taken place on university campuses in particular between religious elements and more secular elements as well. Now, this is the sort of thing that can divide Tunisian society. So that is not extremely clear what's going to happen in that particular case. And that's probably the best example that we have of a country that might transition into democracy. But one more point on this is the question of the Brotherhood first saying that they were going to run for less than half the seats and then running for as many as they possibly could. And then the Brotherhood saying they weren't going to run for the presidency and then running for the presidency. In Egypt, yes. The Brotherhood is, we tend to give it complete agency in this. When we say the Brotherhood will do this because it's going to do what it says it will do, and so on and so forth. These are people like any other politicians, like any other people in the public sphere. They seize their opportunities and they takes them, as the old saying goes, the old Tammany saying goes. And so if they perceive a vacuum, they're going to move into that vacuum. If, for example, they see that it is much better in their interest to work with a broader coalition, they will work with that broader coalition. So it's not that they're always defining the situation that they're in. They're very often defined by the situation they're in.
So in terms of, the Iranian Revolution, of course, even though it caught people by surprise and they managed to get rid of the leftist elements and the progressive elements and really turn the clock back, they've been around for a long time, for decades, and they seem pretty solid at this point. And they seem to have, even though they're very unpopular, but they've successfully quashed the Green Movement. Saudi Arabia, I talked to some of the Saudi opposition, of course, maybe they're wishful thinkers. They indicate that if there is an uprising there, it will be actually quite secular, that because of the oppressive nature of the Wahhabi structures that the royal family used in a way to keep everybody in line, there may be quite a reaction against that. How would you predict a revolution in Saudi Arabia if indeed you think one's coming?
First of all, I think that the people that you were talking to are very optimistic about what the future holds for Saudi
Arabia. I kind of think that way, too. Yeah.
There is a term that's been bandied about in describing several of these regimes called coup-proofing. These regimes in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, and in Saddam Hussein's Iraq have been able to take extraordinarily unstable states and stabilize them within a authoritarian structure. And they've done this in several ways. Most importantly, what they've done is they've put what's called coup critical positions in the hands of kin or their own minority group or tribal elements in some cases as well. And then what they do is they outreach into various other members of the community, and then they build multiple security apparatuses, multiple military units, some of which are directly not within the regular command structure, but directly through, for example, the royal family or through, in the case of Syria, Bashar's brother, Maher, who runs the presidential guard. So these have been extraordinarily stable regimes. And the stability, for example, is shown in what's going on in Syria. Between 1946, when Syria got its independence, and 1970, when Hafez al-Assad took over, there were 10 coups d'etats. There hasn't been one since. And it's very unlikely that Hillary Clinton's prediction that Bashar will be overthrown in a coup d'etat is going to come to fruition at all. I mean, that's incredibly unlikely. In the case of these regimes, what would have to happen is they will either crush the opposition or they will be crushed by the opposition. There's not going to be a Tunisia and Egypt scenario for those regimes, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Algeria could be thrown into that mix as well, Syria, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq, of course, had to be overthrown by an outside invasion. So they're not going to one part of the regime is not going to move against another part of the regime, as happened in Egypt and in Tunisia. And there's not going to be a Yemen or Libya scenario either, where the regimes are going to fragment. These regimes, the people in these regimes, know that they are either going to have to all hang together or they will hang separately. Sure. Their backs against the wall.
But James Galvin, clearly Syria is at a standoff in the sense that even though the opposition is underarmed, they're going to be well financed by the Saudis. Asymmetrical warfare is such that it can really paralyze a country. So it seems to me a situation where the opposition can't win, but the government can't control the country either totally. And it could go on for a long time. But as it goes on, it seems to me you already have instability in Turkey. Turkey's going to reach a critical mass when there's over 100,000 refugees, something up to 50,000 already, and that's probably a low figure. It's already impacting Iraq, because the Sunni in Iraq, who are the ones that lost the war and are very surly about that, they're on that area border. They're supporting their co-religionists. It's also affecting Jordan. Jordan seems to be the most likely supply route through which the Saudis will be sending their arms and money. So give me, in the last few minutes, give me a sense of how, even though you say there's a kind of stability of brutality in Syria, there's the instability of the area because it is essentially a proxy war between the Saudi and the Gulf and the Iranians, isn't it?
Well, the United States has adopted a position of just watching and waiting, sanction here, sanction there, I mean, that sort of thing, pushing through the United Nations. But what the United States really fears is not that the regime will crush the opposition. What the United States really fears is that the opposition wins and one of two scenarios takes place. Number one, Syria will just fragment into sectarian enclaves, into between Kurds and Arabs and so
right.
on.
It'd be like Somalia with chemical and biological arsenals on the list.
Right.
Really,
right.
really dire scenario.
Right. And even worse than Somalia is, as you pointed out, the neighborhood that Syria is in, the impact that all this would have, for example, on Lebanon, on the Israel border, on the border with Turkey and Iraq. Already there's also problems around the Kurdish question in Syria. So you have that problem. Then the other thing that the United States fears, maybe justifiably, maybe not, is a Syrian Muslim Brotherhood takeover. Now, after Hama, 1982, the massacre that took place in Hama when 10 to 20,000 people were murdered by the regime through shelling of the city, we've pretty much lost Brotherhood is from our radar screens. We really don't know what it is at this point. We don't know how it's shifted, how it might have changed, if at all. So we really don't want, the American policymakers really don't want to see the Brotherhood in power. One other aspect, which is that if central governments lose control over their territory, that is a prime means by which jihadists enter into those territories. And the border, for example, between Syria and Lebanon is one such area. It's already taken place in Yemen. So I think that the American government is very, very fearful that the regime is not going to be able to just end this thing in some manner, whatever manner it takes. The Kofi Annan thing appears to be pretty much of a non-starter. What the regime looks like it's doing is keeping the level of violence low enough that it won't trigger a Libya-type response on the part of the West or the Arab League. So I don't see that option as working out either.
But do you think, just in closing, do you think that the U.S. must be tempted by the idea that they could strike a blow against Iran and that the Israelis must be tempted that they could strike a blow against Iran and Hezbollah, their two most lethal enemies?
I think that the one state that is thinking along those lines is Saudi Arabia. I don't think that the United States is looking at it in those lines. I don't think that the Israelis are really looking at it in those lines. There's too many other things that are going on with the United States and the Israelis. We're both too invested in this regime. The Saudis
You're talking about the Assad regime.
The Assad regime, right, exactly.
That may strike our audience as being a little surprising and deeply cynical.
Well, the border with Israel has been quiet since 1973.
Sure. Which is what the Muslim Brotherhood say. They say Assad's working for the Israelis.
Right, know? Right. Yeah. And the Americans, basically, they like the idea of somebody who can keep this hodgepodge, which is Syria, together. But the Saudis have shifted, I think, their foreign policy in the most recent period. What the Saudis have done has been to take a very, very forward position where they have always been shrinking into the background, letting other people take care of it. At this point, they perceive that American power in the Middle East has diminished to such an extent that what they have to do is to take things in hand themselves. Hence, the noises they're making about Syria. Hence, for example, the very strong stand that they took in Bahrain, where they actually invaded the country, and hence the strong stand that they've taken in Yemen as well. And they're also financing various of Islamic parties throughout the region.
Well, we could talk on here quite a bit, and we've run out of time, James Gelbin, but I thank you for your book, The Arab Uprising, What Everyone Needs to Know, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with James Gelbin, Professor of History at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book just out is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.